So today, we're as I said yesterday. I mean, you all are in for a really great treat this quarter, and it really starts out with a bang today. What a really incredible, fortunate way to start out the whole quarter to have these two guests who have been so involved throughout their careers in really both sides of the picture that we're going to be talking about all quarter with a variety of people. Nancy Barron is a zoologist and science writer. She's the Ocean Science Outreach Director for COMPASS, a major science communications project nationally and around the world, based in Santa Barbara. She's also the lead communications trainer for the Aldo Leopold Leadership Program. She works with scientists, helping them translate their work effectively to journalists, the public, and policy makers. She holds training sessions with scientists around the world, with graduate students and postdocs. And it's a real treat to have Nancy here and to have this opportunity for you as undergraduates to interact with her. I mean, as you think about your future career, she has training in science, a master's degree in global marine science from the University of British Columbia, a Bachelor of Science in Zoology, and has won numerous science writing awards. In a couple of years ago, she completed the book that you now know very well, in this fabulous book about escaping from the ivory tower and engaging with the rest of the world on the stuff that really matters. This book that you're reading really summarizes more than a decade of her work with scientists, actually doing it and drawing the lessons out of it. And it's a great, thank you for being here, Nancy. Ken Weiss writes on science, environment, and public health for the Los Angeles Times. He graduated from UC Berkeley, where he was the editor-in-chief of the student-run newspaper, The Daily California. Before coming to the Los Angeles Times in 1990, he was a Washington correspondent for the New York Times regional newspapers. At the LA Times, he's covered education, government, and politics, and was an assistant city editor in Ventura for a while, before he went on to become cover the coasts and oceans and really carve out a beat for himself covering, top national writer, reporter on coasts and oceans, and that probably can be extended globally. He was the lead reporter, for the Altered Oceans Project several years ago, a five-part series, much like the project that you've been reading, but on the oceans, called Altered Oceans. And that series won a George Polk Award and a Pulitzer Prize. Ken developed a love for the ocean as a boy growing up in Southern California. So he's a home boy, fishing, surfing, and diving off the coast in Newport Beach, things that he still constantly does and loves. And so please join me in welcoming them and thanking them for being here with us today. Let's start out by asking Nancy, why did you get into this? Why did you make that transition from being a writer to the work that you do now?
So I was just looking around the room. I look at all your faces, and I was remembering when I was at the point of deciding what was I going to do with my life. I couldn't decide whether I should go into English and writing and maybe being a journalist, or whether I should go to sciences. So it's really a flip of a coin. And, it's so much of life is who you meet and, what happens. And I was so lucky just to meet some really cool people in my very first year of university who were starting this first environmental studies program. And that was what kind of swung me in that direction. So I became a biologist. I was really lucky in those days because when I was going to university, I'm Canadian. I landed a job working for parks. I was a park naturalist. It's meant that I, you know, the nature walks, the dogs. And every year I went to, I managed it, so I went to the entire ecosystem. One year it was the coast, so I learned everything I could about the coastal ecosystem. And then I said, hey, excuse me, could you send me to the Rockies? And so then it was like learning the alphabet. So then I applied myself to, you know, what were the animals, the ecosystems of the Rockies. And then, you know, I kept sort of going to different environments. And I sort of was on this track to become a scientist, but increasingly I just felt like, you know, so many people don't know what is really happening and all the pressures on the natural world. And I was working in national parks, and I thought, it's a bubble. So I started thinking about, how do I talk to a wider audience? So I started, like, oh, God, how do I become a journalist? I can remember thinking about this endlessly. Like, how do I crack it? And I was too late. I was finished university. I should have done what you just said. Everybody, you should all go to their thing tonight and sign up, because that could change it. Look at him. He's testimony to that. You know? So it's about sort of pursuing these connections. Anyways, so I just was relentless, and one thing leads to another. And increasingly, first of all, you know, I got one little thing published in the local paper, and in ways that I talked myself into a newspaper column about natural history stuff called field notes. And then I just kept trying to elbow it and scale it up, you know, and starting to do magazine stories, and, you know, you take one thing and you leverage it to the next. And I was really starting to have a good time. It was like, this was really happening for me as a writer. But I started having that same old naggy feeling that I was having when I was a biologist working in parks, saying, you know, things aren't changing fast enough. And there's a lot of things going on that I think are really, truly problematic. So I just want to ask you, you know, I was sitting here thinking, because we had this interesting lunch discussion with the faculty. So I'm going to ask three relevant questions to our conversation. One, how many of you think it's absolutely essential to communicate what you know about the environment to others? Hands up. How many of you think that with all the competing things that vie for your time, that it's essential that you make time to do that? That it gets a real, at least a 20% slice of your time? Okay, and how many of you want to change the world? Why are you here? Are you here because you want to change the world? Yeah, okay. So you don't have time not to work on being a good communicator, because there's a link between communications and leadership. And whether you want to be a scientist, whether you want to be a writer, one of the most important keys to your success is being able to articulate your vision, focus an argument, and make it compelling even to those who don't agree with you. And these are the skills that apply to the environment that John is really going to help you with and expose you to people who are doing that in a whole huge range of ways. Because, you know, the thing is, where do you go? And so what's wonderful about this course is all of the different avenues and ways that you can engage that, and the people. It's about making connections with the people, too, so that you can follow up on those connections when you see an opportunity or have a question. So don't think of this as a one-hour hit and run. Think of every single class that you come here is a chance to make connections with these people that may advance you at some point in your life and career as you go forward, and realize your dreams and change the world.
So one of the things that some of the students may do, they'll, you know, have opportunities to do different kinds of projects, but one of them may, one of those may be interviewing a scientist and writing a story or making a short video or a podcast, you know, about that scientist, that environmental scientist's work. And I wonder if we could start out by just, you know, saying, you know, asking the question, you know, as they go in to talk to the scientists, to put themselves in the scientists' shoes. What is the scientist, what do you as a scientist, you know, the scientists you work with, what do they want out of that relationship? Out of somebody coming to write or tell a story? Somebody like Ken or somebody like one of the students, what do they want out of that?
Well, okay, the further up you get up the food chain as a scientist, the more you become fearful of those sorts of encounters. Like right now, you'd probably think it was a blast, right, to be interviewed by a journalist. Might make you a little bit nervous. But what scientists often think about are their fears, because they become isolated, and they are mostly used to talking to each other. So they forget about other audiences. They forget about the wider world. They forget about all the people who they meet in the rest of their life, and they're really just scared about what are their colleagues going to think. So what they want is to make sure that it's accurate, that they don't, that it, they feel that they have not been misquoted. But the important thing for the scientist to remember is that if the person doesn't get it when they're talking to them, they probably didn't give it. And so often the sources of being misquoted is because they weren't clear. So the other thing that I think scientists struggle with a lot is they want to keep it right about the science. They don't want to bring themselves into the story. So it's about finding a way to make them relax. So what you want to do is establish a bit of a personal connection with them, and if possible, get them to talk about themselves as well as just the content, to make it really interesting, because your readers or your audience might not be interested necessarily in that subject, but people are always interested in people, and especially the quirky stuff.
So Ken, when you go into that situation, into that, what do you want out of that relationship with the scientist?
I want them to open up. Let me ask a quick question. How many of you in this room would like to dabble or have a career in writing or science writing or something one way or another? Okay, all of you. Okay, so there's a couple tips that I can offer into getting to scientists, which is hard. So, I mean, you had classes here. These scientists, they're busy. They've got teaching schedules. They try to write. They're, you know, publish papers. They've got a whole lab full of graduate students and postdocs, right? You know, they're busy. They're running, right? And so one way to get them is if you're interested in a particular topic, they go to these conferences. And they're free for a moment, at least, and sometimes several days, of all those pressures that they get back. So if you could ever, it's one way, you know, for trawling for them, essentially, you know, is to go to these conferences. And it's a great way to get them. And the other way is, and this is my best secret, I think, you want to interview them in the bar after they've had at least one drink. and before they hit that third or fourth drink, that's what I highly recommend. I want them to let down their guard and to sort of talk freely. And alcohol can help. It can be your friend when you're researching it, because they sort of let down the sort of all that the jargon starts to slip away. It starts to speak like a human being, and that's really what we need as storytellers. We need that kind of sort of frank, general talk about what they do. Our job really is in some ways translating. But they're the best translator. You just coax it out and give up all their jargon and come up with good, and help you come up with good analogies of what they do and explain things. So.
But I think you've both said, I mean, what you want to do is establish some kind of relationship. I mean, that, you know, some kind, you know,
connection.
Some kind of connection, some kind of human connection, some sort of warmth where you're telling each other stories. I mean, do you ever share? I've found sometimes that it helps if I share a story. Do you ever do that?
If I can come up with one that doesn't sound stretched, yeah.
Fishing or scuba diving or surfing or whatever it might be. I mean, a way that you relate too as a human being. I mean, you're not just a transcription machine.
Right, exactly. I mean, and you know, every scientist that you're going to interview, they probably are fairly well accomplished. And they were driven by, among other things, ego. And so you can play to that in a way that doesn't sound, you know, sickeningly flattering. But, you know, if you do a little homework and read some of their work or, you know, you saw them talk or whatever, you could reference it and say, you know, when you made that point in this paper, I thought that was really interesting, and I wanted to ask you a little bit more about that. I mean, something. So they realize you're, you know, you've done your homework, you're establishing your own creds as somebody who can, you know, can communicate with them, you know, not on a real base level, but on a higher plane. And when you do this for a while, the other thing that I do, I mean, you know, it sounds terrible, but sort of shamelessly, you know, name-dropping of people we know in common, you know. Oh, I was talking to so-and-so that they know, you know, the same field, and they said this. What do you think about that? You know, and so you work it any way you can.
So if we go back, I mean, to go back to the other side of the coin, I mean, you've done some preparation, you've read some of their work, you know who they've worked with, you know who you can talk about, the kind of context for their work so that you can talk about it, ask questions, some knowing questions, and so on. You've done your homework as an interviewer. Now, let's go back to the other side of the equation, Nancy. I mean, the interviewee, the scientist, what's the homework that, you know, if you're an environmental scientist or, you know, and you are, you know, wanting to communicate your story, what's the homework that you should do, which is a lot what your book is about? And I know you've got some things you want to run through. Does it seem like a good time to run through some of those basic things?
Sure,
which I think is also, you know, is also helpful for thinking about your stories. You know, as they work on their story, some of these same tools are helpful.
So, while you're just pulling that up, there was this brilliant scientist named Steve Schneider, a climate scientist, who sadly died a couple of years ago. He's also one of the best scientist communicators I have ever met. And he had his three know thys. Said, know thy audience, know thy stuff, and know thyself. And if you go into an interview and you know what you want to say, and you have a sense of who you're talking to, and what they might be interested in and care about, and you also know what your own boundaries are, that those are the three key ingredients for a really good interview. And a good interview is nothing more than a really great conversation. And if at the end of it, you sort of feel like, wow, we really had a good talk, and I thought about things I haven't thought about before, and you know, and if the other person goes away with that same feeling, that is a successful interview. It's not just about question-answer. It's really about a dance. So I'll just quickly.
I can drive if you'd like. Or why don't you go ahead?
No, that's fine.
Okay.
All right, so anyways, the thing, having been both a scientist and a journalist, that I quickly learned is that scientists and journalists are almost like two sides of the same coin, except scientists are obsessive compulsives, and journalists are ADD. And many scientists many scientists become journalists because they just can't stand, you know, going into things that deeply. And often the reverse is true too. But there's so many of the actual same characteristics of the two types of people. So there's this appetite to discover new things. right? New stories, new ideas, new science, new questions. Okay,
yeah.
Scientists and journalists are both analytical and skeptical. They question things, they challenge things. Want to get there first, want to be the best. And are independent thinkers, don't just always follow the herd. And most importantly, and this is actually, you know, where it can all happen, the magic can occur. And that's because both scientists and journalists love what they do. You know, it's this blurry line between work and play. And so nobody who makes it as a scientist or a journalist is a 9-to-5-er. It's like what you think about in the shower. It's what you talk about over drinks. And when journalists and scientists get together, there's all sorts of, you know, great things that can happen as they share these ideas. So there's a lot in common about those appetites and that quest for discovery. But there is this huge dividing line between the two worlds. Right? So I've just drawn a little picture that kind of sums it up. So for scientists, it's all about, think about how you write a paper. It's the background, methods, materials, results, discussion, and then finally, you know, the results and conclusion. And when you're talking to a journalist, they want you to give them the bottom line first. So you have to flip it over. And in fact, everybody else does too, right? If you go to a poster session and you know you're there with somebody like Ken, he's walking along, like looking at these posters at the bottom line. And then if that gets his attention, he'll go up and read the rest. And so the tricky thing, for the more you get to know, the more you have to work at thinking, how do I start with my bottom line first and turn it on its head? And then if people are interested, they'll ask you more questions and pull it out of you. So it's this whole idea of cutting to the chase. And that's, you know, you hear a lot about the elevator speech and, you know, how do you distill your thought into a headline? It's just critically important, and this is a discipline. Okay, so, you know, there are these differences, and I'm not going to go into these in depth, but they're, you know, more about this in the book. And one of the biggest differences I already talked to is that, you know, scientists are trained not to talk about themselves. They write in the passive voice. You know, they speak in the passive voice. The results were analyzed. They don't want to talk about the fact that they actually did it. So this is a tension. And you know, it really is. Don't fall into that trap. Bring yourself into it. And no matter what you do, no matter what conversations you're having, you know, whether you're on the journalist side or on the scientist side, you are interesting. And think about, you know, bringing yourself into it, making that human connection, because as we were saying, it all comes down to, you know, at the end of the day, the relationships we make and the connections we make. And there's this huge tension between the flow and the pace at which these two worlds work. And this little cartoon kind of sums it up. Today, I'm an expert in politics, economy, car repair. It goes down to liposuction, world peace. In order to be a good journalist, you've got to be a quick study. So you have to be able to get there really fast. And most really good journalists know a little about a lot of things. And they may even be a PhD, but they still need to know a little about many, many more things, because they've got to be able to cover all this ground really fast. But on the scientist side, it's, you know, well, it's like, you know, 4 or 5 years, or how many years to get a PhD? So when a journalist needs to file a daily story, that's sort of, you know, kind of a little bit at odds. Okay, so I'm going to give you just one example of this is actually about how do you make a pitch.
Here's on another PowerPoint, right?
No, it's just jump ahead to, yeah, up that.
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
Back one. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So we're all on right. The podium.
Yeah, so scientists can make pitches to journalists. And journalists can make pitches to, you know, media where they want to actually tell a story. But the principles are the same. And this little tool called the message box that I talk about in my book can be a very useful sorting tool for thinking about, figuring out that what is it that I really want to say, what is the most important thing I want to say. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about this woman, Jennifer Balch, who is the one holding, it's actually fuel that she's about to pour on this fire in the forest and then light it. She's a postdoc who was at this place where I work in Santa Barbara, associated with UCSB. And she was working on how fires that get out of control in the Amazon are contributing to climate change. And this was something that nobody was factoring into the equation. And, you know, as they deforest, after they deforest, they burn these patches that they slash. And often these fires get out of control. And so she was part of a team that were trying to measure the impact that this is having. And, you know, it was the amount that this happens is huge. So she used the message box, which simply asks, you know, the questions. The first of all is, what's the issue? Okay, that wildfires are on the rise. What's the problem? That these these fires are actually increasing with climate change and getting worse and worse. It's sort of like a vicious circle because it's getting drier, the conditions are such, the fires are more frequent, and humans are continuing to deforest. And so she was figuring out the so what. Anyways, it's not so important, the particulars, but the fact was that she spent the time, and this is after she just, you know, really did a big brain dump and then chiseled out the four most important points she wanted to make. And so she had that straight in her head. And then she wrote a pitch. And her idea was, I'm going to the Amazon, we're going to do a controlled burn. Maybe I can get some journalists interested in covering this as a story. So how do I take these main things I get across and put it into my pitch note? So I want you to just take a second to read this and then tell me what she did that made this so effective. Okay, yeah.
It's very humanized. Right away you get the sense that it's a real person, which scientists sometimes don't convey that well.
Yeah.
It's more engaging.
And you think she sounds interesting, right? You'd want to talk to this woman.
Sense of humor, and that
yeah.
Is another stereotype that's sort of invalidated immediately.
Yeah. What else? Yes.
Her first sentence, given your experience writing about environment and climate change issues, is a big clue that she researched the individual that she is requesting and sending a pitch to so that she doesn't have to restate or iterate anything that's already common knowledge to the children.
Right. Know thy audience. Good. What else?
She catches the reader's attention just in the second sentence and she just starts burning with the Amazon. That's like an adventure or something that really catches your attention.
Right. Okay, so a journalist comes into work, and overnight they've got like 200 new emails. And they're just looking at the headers, right? And they're going down the row, they're going, delete, 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 delete. And they go, oh, scientists burning the Amazon. So that's always a good technique, overturning conventional wisdom, right? Turn something on its head, surprise people, get their attention with, you know, something that seems perverse. What else? Yeah.
The end of that sentence makes it seem like if you get in on this now, like this could be a big story to get in on. So it sort of makes the journalist
Yeah, yeah, and that this is an unanswered question, right? There's something, there's a mystery to be solved here, and that she may, if you go with her on this trip or if you follow along with her, you may find out the answer to that and be the first there, like you said. The first is always good. Yeah. Yes?
I think there's also a pretty serious sense of just immediacy in it because, like you said, it's, I mean, the word dramatic is in it too, so because it's immediate and questioning too, that brings people in.
Right. Anything else? Yeah.
I think what the informal, not informal, but more spiritual writing, when she says, see a bunch of researchers and then it's a bit crazy. I think that just on the baby catch the attention that a scientist is writing.
Yes, but what's the counterpoint to that that doesn't make her sound like she's just a complete wacko? What does she also do? Yeah.
I'm working with the Woods Hole Research Center.
Bingo. She establishes her creds, right? That's a very reputable institution. So she's got character, but she's no flake. You know, she's with this reputable group of scientists. All right. Yeah.
She immediately also establish the parameters of time so that if an individual is interested or not, they can either they have time to between August 26th and 28th. She let them know up front when it was going to happen because oftentimes people don't have time to check, like, well, when do you want me? So she answered questions ahead of time to save time.
Right. Yes, and she also wrote it a month out.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it might... Exactly. You know, they might not be able to go to the Amazon in that time frame, but at least they could place, you know, put it on their radar screen in their story, you know, kind of lineup to think about how would I do this. Yeah, exactly. Good. Okay, you guys have done a great job on this. But okay,
can I add one more thing?
Yeah.
So too often scientists want to tell you about what they did 6 months ago or a year ago, you know, and it's like, you know, and this is great. I'm cluing you in early. Is, you know, how can you not be interested?
Okay, real quick. All right, there she is burning down the Amazon. Okay, look what happened. A story in The Economist. And get this, read this. Look, just look at the highlighted parts. Lifted right out of that email, which sounded breezy, but she really did her homework. It was all about being prepared, doing her message box, knowing what she wanted to say, and then taking it the next step to making it really compelling and memorable. So that's what you want to do with your pitch. And I know you're going to be doing those.
Yeah, make your pitches to me like that. Please. So let's...
This is sort of just like a technical question, but like we're not...
So and I know when we've been doing these things, you don't have to introduce you every time. But when you're going to ask a question, also because there's rewards for asking good questions, I'll remind you. Just state your name.
Elizabeth Case.
Okay.
So if a scientist like sent you that email, this is really just a technical question, but like generally for the Daily Bird, I guess we don't like. Quotes
from emails, is that like eaten alive if we used to direct quote from an email?
Yeah. Is that
standard?
I don't know. Just curious about like standards are like around.
Right. Should I weigh on this? I mean, I would never do that. I would
but The Economist does.
Yeah. I mean, the standards, they shift, you know, sometimes. And, you know, increasingly we'll see, particularly in volume. People look at things from email, and you know, since I think you folks are probably interested in climate change, you may have seen Dot Earth, right? Yeah. Which is Andy Revkin, who is running so fast. Hey, is he coming?
Yeah.
You'll see him, and he's transparent about it. He said, "I asked in an email, and this is what someone came back," and he'll literally cut and paste what they said. So he's transparent about it. So I didn't interview them formally. Very often, I mean, it shows how fast he's moving. He'll send an email with the same questions to, you know, half a dozen to a dozen people. You could ask him when he comes. And then see who comes back, and he'll sort of take what he wants. And it's a very efficient way to do it. It obviously came from that person, so it's probably legitimate, you know, but, you know, and it's transparent.
Yeah.
And so that's how he handles it. But we wouldn't do that if it's short. I mean, same training you have, which is, that's another.
Yeah. Yes.
So, hi, my name is Rita Blake. And so if you're interviewing a scientist, I suppose that's one thing. But say for your project, the 7 Billion Project, where you interviewed the people from India, the couple that had the child really early, how do you approach a subject like that? Or how do you approach people like that where there's maybe a sense of feeling of possible inequality or a feeling of maybe mistrust of someone? So how do you approach those types of subjects as opposed to scientists who might be easier to approach because there's less of a cultural or economic or social barrier between you and the subject?
Very gingerly. I'm not sure I quite get what the question is, but let me just assume that it's just, well, how do you establish rapport with someone like that? It takes a while. And, you know, it's particularly difficult when you don't share the same language. So we're working through a translator. And it's particularly, in this case, you know, it was very difficult. We're out in Rajasthan in a small village, 2,000 people. You know, in the family compound, interviewing two basically face-to-face white guys with cameras rolling, interviewing people about their sexual family practices. It's tricky. You have to you go in slow, and you start asking questions. And the best way to interview, particularly on delicate topics, if you have the luxury of time, and I did on this. You interview one, and you do the more cursory stuff, and then you slowly—it's like peeling layers of the onion—and you just slowly get into it. And it's not always necessarily the stuff you want to know right away, if you really want to get to. But you start asking more generic and easy questions about the family and the history and what they like to do and their hopes and dreams and aspirations and things like that, just to start establishing a relationship. You know, and do the same thing that John talked about, which is, you know, who are we and why are we there? Why are we interested? So you kind of, and it's awkward through a translator. And it's even more awkward when you're videotaping the whole thing. But with time, you know, that's how you start establishing rapport. Because after a while, I don't like to operate the camera. I always had my buddy Rick Loomis operating. He puts it in and he kind of sets it back a little bit. He's always fiddling with his cameras and acting like he's not paying attention. Then people will forget the camera after a while. So that's really helpful.
If I can follow up, similarly, did you find them and select them, or did you put out sort of an open call and they came to you?
The way I found them, and we were going to get into a little bit of this later. Go ahead now.
Yeah, yeah.
What I found in doing this series was the best way for me to find, to ground truth the theories and ideas that scientists had about what was happening, and also then go out and find examples that would sort of hopefully show, not tell, what these trends are, is to work with nonprofit, non-governmental organizations, NGOs that work on the ground. And that's who our guide was. We had a series of interlocking NGOs that worked in that area, and a lot of them were specifically working on trying to stop child marriage. Right? That's their goal. And because in India, half of girls are married before they're 18, even though it's illegal, and even though it's hidden and all this, the enforcement slacks. It's very difficult to stop. It's a long-standing tradition, and so they know people, essentially in communities. And so, we were in Ludhiana, and then they knew somebody out in this Tiberi village where we went. They had a caseworker out there, and so it was, this sort of thing. And what you don't see in the series is we probably interviewed, a dozen people similar to this. I just thought that their story was particularly compelling, and so you cast a wide net and then you winnow and.
Would you like to, should we roll this video?
Your video?
If you want.
You tell me. I mean,
whatever.
Okay.
Yep. to begin to swallow.
We're facing one of the biggest train wrecks in human civilization. How are we going to feed 9 billion people without trashing the planet at the same time?
This idea of thinking about population isn't driven by a single number.
How many people the Earth can support depends on natural constraints which we do not fully understand and human choices which we have not yet made.
We only have so many resources in this world. There are not infinite amounts of resources.
We live in a world today where nearly a billion people will go to bed hungry tonight.
We've got 85 million more births and deaths every year on this planet.
Big part of the story for reducing birth rates is investing in children and saving those children's lives and creating an expectation that, yes, your children will have the chance to lead a healthy and productive life.
To have a population that the Earth can sustain, we need to look both at the population numbers and how much people consume. You can't take one without the other.
We currently consume resources on planet Earth as if the Earth were about 50% more productive than it actually is.
We've literally farmed a planet, and now we have to double that. And we don't have any frontiers left to discover.
We have a propensity to use up all available resources, and we're doing that with greater success than any other species on the planet.
We've got to figure out how to use resources more sustainably now so that they still exist. Our future, the young people's future, know that we are compromising so dramatically by our inability to address what are absolutely addressable problems.
that's a, I mean, there's a, it's an incredible beauty and art that is in that, you know, along with these really intense, focused ideas, important, very important ones. And then, I mean, moments where it's communicating without words for quite long stretches, which I think shows the different ways that that we can communicate about these issues powerfully. I want to open it up now and talk both, you know, to all of your questions as well, and talk about that art that goes into the production of it, the writing, as well as the other elements of it. But to go back for a moment, I mean, to the ideas, I mean, this is a huge, complicated project. And, you know, you all won't be taking on anything quite so huge, I hope, you know, in one quarter, and you had, you know. But as Nancy showed in her, in the message box, what methods did you use, I mean, to kind of, you know, analytically actually begin to sort of say, well, I'm going to do this and this and this, and I'm not, you know, to kind of focus the project. How do you do that?
Okay. You know, before I do that, do you mind? I would love to get a little feedback on what you thought of this, just your impressions of our trailer to the project.
My name's Jessie, and one of my favorite parts was just the gap that you left between each of the voices for like the audience to have a reaction to what was said. And then I really liked the one quote about it's the younger generation's problem that was from a more distinguished voice. I think it gave it kind of like the appeal.
My name's Pam Thompson. I watched that earlier today, actually, and I found it really powerful, but my instant reaction was like, why are they all men speaking? Especially when they're talking
that's
about women having an equal say. It just kind of like immediately had this knee-jerk reaction, and then I was like, even though I feel like we have this propensity not to focus on these other places in the world, and I think it's really important to focus on their like global environmental problems, but it was just like, if we're talking about consumption, like you could show a picture of like Beverly Hills, you know? And that might be kind of interestingly interspersed in that, because like we're part of the 7 billion. And I don't know.
Yes.
My name is Raquel, and I just really like the music behind everything. It really, I don't know, it added an extra pitch of like reflection and thinking, less words and more like personal thinking.
My name is Clément, and I think that the use of the pronoun we is a BS, because in fact, when you speak about we, the overexploitation of the planet, and it's maybe more of the West than the other part of the planet. And it's also, yes, maybe when you speak about, when the video speaks about conflict, you only show Muslim people in maybe it was Qatar or a country, but Muslim country. When you speak about overfishing, you see images from the third world, or maybe images from big boats from Europe, Norwegian, would have been more powerful. When you speak about clean water, you also show images from the third world. And agriculture, it would be more powerful to speak about the US or France, which are countries with a very harmful way of exploiting the agriculture. And when you speak about food, you show a family in Africa, and we are in the US, so food is a very important issue there. And images from maybe the opposition of the third world and the West would have been good things about this video. I think the, but it's just my opinion, the messages would have been very powerful with more opposition between different way of style. And this opposition is the base of our conception about 9 billion people on the Earth. And it's maybe more a problem of allocation of resources than just there is too many people on the Earth.
Okay.
Just my opinion.
I like when it was included about things are not yet understood and not yet decided, because it the word yet, it kind of puts a limit that we expect to get there, and the fact that you say not yet still give me room to believe I could still figure out something that might really make a big chance.
My name is Elizabeth, and I actually wanted to maybe bounce off what you just said, in that seeing that it's for the LA Times, it's sort of directed towards us in the West, and we already know what we're doing, I think, and so it's sort of, I thought it worked for me, because it's seeing how you're not showing what the West is doing, but how it does have impacts, and there's sort of these gaps and changes between the populations of the world.
I actually want to tag on or kind of expand on what Raquel said. My name is Jennifer, by the way. How much say do you have in the artistic production of this? Because, like our professor said, there's a lot of like not talking, or like this isn't writing at all. Do you get a say in the music and the shots? You said you have the camera sometimes, but like, do you like make sure it's the message you want to convey?
These are all good questions.
Turn it.
I'm actually a citizen. I'm from Jaipur, Rajasthan.
Oh, you are?
Yeah. And when I watched it, I kind of felt bad, because I was like, it sort of shows like a general, like, it makes my country look like it's just poor. So I think if, like, I know it is for LA Times, so you, majority of the audience will not be, like, native Indian. But I think it kind of, like, hurt me somehow, because, like, it just showed, like, the bad parts. I mean, but that's any country, right? Like, no country is just, like, consistently rich. Or, like, you know. Sorry, that was my opinion.
You're a long way from Jaipur.
Yeah.
My name's Lena. I just want to say, I thought it was a very compelling video in just 5 minutes. For someone like us, and I think everyone in the room, environmental science majors, it's kind of what we all really feel. Like, there's a sense of immediacy that you get from watching the video, and it's something that, like, I would want to share, and I feel like it's easy for people, not just environmental science, who already care about this issue, but people just, anyone, could really understand and get a sense of, like, we have to do something.
We keep
go ahead. I mean, do you want to respond?
Yeah, sure. Okay, one last question, but you need to look over here just real quick. Yeah. How many of you read the series? You know, I think this isn't for a grade. Really, the whole series?
The whole series.
Oh, but you read one piece.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. And many of you read the whole series. Okay, a few of you. Okay, and did any of you see the series when it came out in July? Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
The whole thing.
Okay. All right. So, there are a lot of good points and questions here. Let me just start and also try to open your question. We've decided early on to focus on the developing world, and the reason is right now we just hit 7 billion, you know, about last year, and the best guess is we're going to 9.3 billion, according to the United Nations, by mid-century. 97% of that growth is going to be in the developing world. So that's where the growth's coming. And, you know, and India is going to have the largest share of it. India will become the most populous nation in the world, you know, in the next 8 or 9 years. And almost all the growth is in the poor north, you know, not in the south. And so that's why we focus there, and that's why, we actually picked a family. And you know, if I could have picked the location, it would have been in
Uttar Pradesh because it's the largest state. This state's 200 million people. It's, you know, we're 309 million in this country. So one state in India is all, you know, two-thirds the size of the United States. It's huge. But we just didn't find the right family that I wanted to, so I ended up in Rajasthan, so, which has a big cultural history, as you know, about child marriage. But it's we really, you know, specifically focus, you know, and, you know, in the criticism about, well, what's wrong with the industrial agricultural shots, such, we were really focusing on this is where the growth's coming. This is where people are hurting now. It's where most of the world's poor are now. And it's for the folks who are going to suffer the most. And they're hurting now. We have a billion people who go to bed hungry every night. Despite heroic efforts to try to make that better, it's still a billion people. And, you know, what are we going to do when we have, add another, you know, a couple billion people? You know, maybe it's 2.3, that's the best guess. You know, it could be, you know, if we hit, you know, hit 9.3 billion, it could be 11, it could be 15, depending on what happens. And, you know, what we really wanted to do was go around and sort of not focus so much on the future, because how, we don't really know where it's going to go, but what's happening now in places where there's high growth. So, you know, to the point about conflict and such, I mean, where the conflict is the greatest tends to be the fastest growing countries. And that's almost universally true. And we went to Afghanistan specifically for that. And that's where you saw some of these shots. And that's, you know, there's a 34-year history of conflict in that country. Some would say it's a 1,000-year history. But they've been growing like crazy. And so that's why we really focused on the developing world, and we're not more reflexive about our consumption. Now, in tackling this topic, I mean, the thread through the whole thing was population growth. And it is not something, it's sort of the topic that has been driven off the table. We don't really want to talk about it anymore. We prefer to focus on consumption. And that's a perfectly legitimate thing, to focus on consumption. And we're apex consumers here. You know, it's not just Beverly Hills. I mean, it's all of us, basically, in this country. And I've written tons of stories about this. This is the other side of the equation, because, you know, any scientist who seriously looked at this will tell you that it is not just the level of consumption, but it's the level of consumption times the number of consumers that creates our total impact on the planet and on every natural resource. And so it was just, this was an opportunity to look at the other side. Get to the solution? Nancy wants me to talk about the solution. So, in the series, we alluded to this without being really specific, but because newspapers, I think, generally, are much better at focusing on problems. We are descriptive, not prescriptive, and, you know, except in the editorial pages. I am trying to work up a book about this, so which we will talk about solutions. And what's interesting to me is that there is a common thread throughout all of the problems that we addressed here, as well as the solution. And it really comes down to women and women's power and ability to have control over their lives, you know, their destinies, their families. And we have been great in this country, the rich northern country, sharing technology with the developers. To save lives, you know, we have vaccination programs and efforts to try to curb AIDS and tuberculosis and, you know, and malaria, all sorts of things. And also trying to boost crop production and help feed people. And God love us for it. That's a great thing. But we have been squeamish about sharing our technology to help people, particularly women, plan their families. And there's a lot of opposition and a lot of pushback from religious leaders and from, you know, often tribal leaders and politicians and such. And, you know, it's something we're not so comfortable doing. And helping these folks complete what we've done in all of Europe and the United States, you know, and increasingly far in the Far East as well, to make what scientists call the demographic transition from you know, big families and short lives to smaller families and long lives. And the technology exists. It's not perfect, but it exists. And what we found in our travels over and over again is that when poor women in the most remote places. So these poor, uneducated women with no power in their families or their communities, when they have an option to plan their families and realize that their children will be able to survive, they leap at the opportunity to do so. And so really, one of the solutions to all these problems that you folks, I think, are all concerned about, we all are in this room, you know, is really helping poor people, specifically women, you know, give them some technology and helping them, you know, with education and giving them some power in society. I mean, I'm not sure we get that essentially here. We're a relatively free country. We have issues with glass ceilings and equal pay and things. But it's nothing compared to India, where, I mean, you know, just look at what's going on in the news now with the poor woman, you know, this mass rape. I mean, it's just, women have very little power. You can speak to this far greater than I can, but in many of these countries. And that is, I see it as the solution.
I'm Michelle. One of the interesting things when I was reading part of the series was when you're talking about birth control and family planning, is how you're mentioning how people from here don't like to fund for that for the similar reasons.
Right.
And so I think it's really interesting because, yes, we think that's, because my parents are from Pakistan, so it's somewhat similar. We think like, oh yes, tribal and religious leaders there, but it's interesting to see how it's still that connection here where you can still go into a lot of, not even just small communities, but in big cities, like even here in LA and all over the country, they're also against like family planning, but yet somehow over here you still have, even though they're against family planning in certain senses, they still have smaller families. So I think it's really interesting how we can learn how they've adapted here and maybe try to put those same, like give those ideas over there and to other places as well.
Right. You want me to start?
Yeah, why don't you? Go ahead, yeah.
Right.
That cultural aspect of, in order to understand their entire story and their backgrounds, to translating that and showing readers where their cultural aspects come in and influence their decisions in their lives.
It's tricky. I mean, it's particularly tricky, you know, when you look like me, right? And you know, it just takes time. I mean, you know, I try to do an awful lot of background research on all the cultural pressures and things, and you know, so. For me here, you know, the scientists are often my guides, you know, and the medical, and these would be, if you're getting the family plan, medical physician, the physicians as well, and such, as to what's going on. And then on the ground, I mean, there are folks in, we were talking about India, you know, but, you know, we worked with all sorts of NGOs, is that too jargon, NGOs, is that, you know, in India that, I mean, they worked on child marriage. You know, that we're trying to promote family planning because the government does a very bad job about it, except for sterilizing, you know, people. They're good at that, but not, you know, that's not necessarily always the decision you want to make when you're really young. And, you know, so, you know, you're really working with these folks to try to understand the whole. I mean, it's, you know, and then just to try to slow down a little bit and really take time with people, you're interviewing and really get a sense of it. You know, it was very hard. It was particularly hard to interview women, and you know, because there's a very protective barrier there. It's like you white man, what, get away from our women. You know, this was true in almost all in conservative societies of all kinds, like that, particularly Muslim and you know in Hindu, it was very tough. But you know, over time, you know, you can kind of work around that. It's just tricky.
Could I ask, I mean, Nancy, do you get into those kinds of questions in your work with scientists? I mean, of how different cultural perceptions might change the way stories are told about science or the environment, or is that...
Well, in a lot of the workshops I do, there may be scientists from many different countries, and then there'll be a lot of discussion about how a story that might work in one place would not work in another. So it gets back to the know thy audience aspect of things, and also what's appropriate and what's not. This is a little different, but I did a workshop for a week with scientists in Sweden, and they were all working on aspects of bringing the Baltic Sea back to life, because it has tons of dead zones in it. And, you know, the whole workshop was about being a more effective communicator, and becoming a leader, and going out there and talking and engaging. And one of the big discussions was, there's this thing in Scandinavian countries called Jantelå. And Jantelå is that it's considered culturally inappropriate to stand out and make yourself, you know, to draw attention to yourself. And so this was something that they were really struggling with, you know, the decision to be an agent of change and to, you know, to stand out and speak out. But they decided that, you know, collectively that they were going to overcome this, but it was something that they had to talk about and build a support network amongst themselves, that they felt that this was really important, that they wouldn't cut each other down for doing it, that they would create this supportive network. So, you know, there's the aspect of what's the cultural norm within societies. There's the aspect of what stories resonate within different cultures and what are the aspects of it. And you really do need to have, like you said, for you, it was critical to have the people who lived there on the ground, who had the relationships, who had the trust, and who could also be your guides by the side, sort of say, don't go there, you know, do go there, you know, figuratively and literally.
Well, you guys, and I mean all of you guys, were wonderful, good questions, good critical thinking, good, you know, I just want to applaud you for this first session and your engagement with, you know, what we're doing here and with our guests, and also ask you and thank you again. I feel like we could go on and on with this conversation for much longer. It's so deep and rich and important, but our time is up. And so I hope you'll join me in thanking Ken and Nancy.